Okay. I'm gonna need a reader soon, so whoever wants to read, gonna have a few things. Yeah. So you probably met us in the street talking about politics, talking about geometry, talking about Kepler. So what is it all about? And that's what I want to introduce a bit, the kind of method that we're using right now to try to change the situation, which, well, as Michel has presented it yesterday and the day before, a lot of people are recognizing the threat of, you know, a third world war. So is it going to happen? Well, we have something to do to stop it. And we're going to try to go into Plato's method of how to actually bring a higher hypothesis in the equation. So yeah, that's what I'm going to bring to basically lay the ground for the next classes. So I'm going to touch many things, maybe not going to elaborate much, but I think that in other classes you're going to have a more complete idea. We're trying to get all of this together. So I'm going to need somebody to read now. Luke, you want to read?
Sure.
Okay.
Where am I reading from? From there?
You're going to read this. Do you want to close the light? Is it going to be...
That's it, correct.
Okay. You see well in the back? Okay, good.
Solon's constitution. Never will our city be destroyed by Zeus's decree, nor by the will of the blessed immortal gods. For born of a potent father, great-hearted guardian, Pallas Athena spreads her hands over our city. But by money seduced, the Athenians themselves seek mindlessly to corrupt the great city, joined by the iniquitous schemes of their leaders, who from arrogance great woes shall suffer. For they understand not how to restrain gluttony, nor best to order their feasting in quiet. Sparing neither sacred ground nor public goods, greedily they steal from the one place or the other. They fail to protect the reverend temples of justice. She who notes silently the what is and what has been, who in time shall come exacting retribution. Behold, an execrable harm visits all Athens. To vile slavery is she swiftly progressed, which rouses up from slumber civil strife and war. War that wipes out for many their cherished youth. Now our much-loved city is soon worn down by faction, while the wicked stir them to confrontations. These evils ensnare the whole people. But the poor, many of them depart to a foreign land, plundered and bound up in shameful fetters. For the slave's yoke bears all other wickedness. Thus does the public evil come home to each of us. Straining, the courtyard gates no longer hold fast. The evil leaps over the high walls. It finds everyone, even him fleeing to the inmost chamber. This my soul commands me, teach the Athenians. A bad constitution brings civic turmoil, but a good one shows well ordering and coherence, as it puts shackles round about wrongdoing. It smooths out the tough or the rough. It checks greed, tempers hubris, and withers the fruits of reckless impulse. It takes crooked judgments and makes them straight, softens arrogant deeds, halts seditious acts, and ends the bile of grievous strife. And so under it, everything for mankind becomes whole and wise.
Okay, can you open the light? Please. All right, so that's not yesterday. It was not written yesterday. It was written like almost 3,000 years ago. But did anybody like, do you know a bit Solon, or do you know a bit the situation he was put in, while he lived in, basically? Nobody? All right, well, Solon is called one of the great sages, the wise men of Greece. And he was brought to power in Athens at a time where basically you could become a slave from your debt. Right? Sounds familiar, right? Could become a slave from your debt. Okay. And he's saying also that, you know, people are greedy. But what the fundamental point I wanted to bring to you is the first sentence, which says that, you know, Athens, or it could be applied to the other city-states at the time, won't fall because of Zeus's wrath, you know, the anger of Zeus for the Athenians, but that it would be from the cause would be coming from the people of Athens. So that's where basically we gotta look at our politics right now and see that it's not something outside our world which we makes it move like that, but there's actually a principle which is governing the actions. And it's actually the battle we're in right now goes back 3,000 years ago. And it's really a question about what is your idea, or like this idea of the constitution that Solon talks about. If you have a bad constitution, it's going to lead to civic turmoils. So, but what is the principle? What are the ideas that you have to bring in your constitution to avoid that and to avoid wrongdoing, or to put, like he says, to put shackles around the wrongdoing? So what is the principle there? And Solon, basically what he did is he just said, all right, now we're gonna forgive the debts. Like, you can't enslave people because they have debts. That's not going to work. It actually destroys our land, destroys our people. And, you know, like, people who have money are taking control over others. So, sounds familiar. So the idea is, all right, yeah, the condition, that, you know, the behavior was like that at the time. And we see a bit of a continuation right now. But it has not always been like that. That's what I want to bring also. Because you have two factions, actually. You have the idea of the empire, which has a conception of man, which is not much than a cattle. And you have this conception of the republic, which I'm going to try to bring a bit with Plato, which has another view of man, of mankind, actually. Which is that basically we have creative powers, and that we can understand something about the world which surrounds us, even though it's kind of, we see shadows sometimes. Even if we're not in the dark, even if the sun shines, well, the sun was shining during the Dark Age, but people were seeing shadows. They were not perceiving the real, the real principle behind actions or behind what was going on around them. So, we're going to see these two factions and what they did. So I'm bringing you back to Greece. Well, that's a large map. So, alright, you have Greece here, and you have a large part of the Middle East, Near East. So that's basically,
what's the name beside the Greece? Phrygia or something? À droite?
Phrygia?
Phrygia.
Phrygia. Yeah. So maybe some of you have heard this quote by William Shakespeare. It says that the world is a stage. Well, basically, 3,000 years ago, that was the stage. So everything was really happening around that area in the world. Well, you had other civilizations, but we're going to look basically at that particular spot, because it has, like I said, like 3,000 years ago, it's the same fight as today. So it has an impact if we study it or not. Okay, that's a bit of bigger view of Greece. So you have Greece here, and you have here in the south of it, what we call Italy right now, was called the Greater Greece. And also on the other side, you had Greek colonies in Ionia, where Thales, Thales de Milet, Thales of Miletus, was coming from, just there, Miletus. So basically, the Greek were out on that part, and their common they did not have the same type of government, but the common thing was that they were speaking Greek. That was the. Oui. Oui. Sorry. Yeah. So they were all okay. They were all speaking. All right. All right. Now, they were not alone in the world. There was also Persians. And that's the maximum size of the Persian Empire. Actually, it started like a really tiny spot here, around here, or around Persepolis. So that's pretty huge, and that was controlled by one man, but not really. It was controlled by the emperor. There was something else also, which was controlling the people of that area. And we're going to go through that. So that's pretty massive. That's pretty big. So how did they organize their people? Basically, an empire is a family affair. that's what it is. I don't know if it means the same thing as what I think in French it means. But you go. It's really the idea that you're going to have, you know, a bloodline which is going to bring you all the emperors, and then, you know, the father dies, the son take over, and all of this. So basically, these are the emperors who were from the beginning of the Persian Empire until around the time of Alexander the Great, almost, like there's a few missing. So you have the big names there. Cyrus the Great was the one who actually brought a major part of the empire, and his son also really enlarged it. But he was really the one who was basically put in charge by what we call the Marduk cult, which is M-A-R-D-U-K. And it's part, you have many things around that. You're gonna have an offshoot of that specific cult in Delphi, which we don't see right now on the map. It's in Greece, which is that's how they were organizing actually their empire, around, not really around a religion, but really around a cult, who would basically be the financier of the empire. So they were the money bags. So you better listen to them. Like Solon said, they are the one who are corrupting everybody. But that's the challenge we have to look at right now. How basically the Greek were able to defeat the Persian Empire, even though you look at Greece, it's very small. You know, compared to that huge chunk of land, it's pretty small. And you're going to see the numbers were also proportional. So, you know, these guys, I mean, I'll go back, but these guys, the Persian Empire was growing. And so they were lacking space, right? That's the logic of empires. You need some more space. So they were probably getting fat or something, but too much McDonald's. Or. But they were expanding. And no, actually it was because they were looting all of the territories they were actually conquering. So you go from one place to the other, and you loot everything. There's nothing else. All right. Well, you go at another place, and you loot everything. And you don't loot necessarily everything, because you want people to still give you money, or still give you some wheat. You know? Like the queen wants our wheat right now. And, you know, so you basically, you put people into slavery, to slave labor, and they're going to give you their quota. All right, so the Persians were so glutton that they decided, all right, well, we're gonna go get these Greek, because they're not our friends. I mean, there was a revolt of the Greek, because the Greeks were also on the land, what we call Turkey right now. So there were some Greek colonies there. And actually, when the emperors, the Persian emperors and the army came, well, actually they decided, no, you're not gonna come here and just tell us what to do. You know, so they fought back. They actually lost, but Athens and other city states send some ships to help a bit the colonies, the Greek colonies there, at Miletus and other cities. So the Persian, they had it on their heart. They never forgive them for that. So they said, all right, now we have the power, we have the strength, we have the army. We're going to crush these guys, and they're going to remember it. So basically, they sent two big invasions, really, which were brought by Darius and Xerxes, the father and the son. So basically, they sent their ships, and they sent the troops. And the first battle, probably you heard about that, because you probably listened to the Olympics, right? There was a place called Marathon. That's where basically the names come from. What?
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Wasn't that the name of the guy who ran between two cities?
No. But that's the thing. That's what he did. That yeah. Carl right now, that's marathon, right. Because he went from marathon to, I think it's went to Athens, right? To bring the news that actually the how much were they? It's kind of the 3,000 Greeks had defeated the 60,000 Persian mercenaries. Oh. So basically, he was like, "All right, we won." So he ran the marathon. So basically,
he just started running.
Why? He had to bring the news to to the population. Hey, we did it. We won. So basically, that was a major battle. That was not the only one, but that was the first really great battle, which the Greeks won. And so, yeah, they were 3,000, and the Persian mercenaries were 60,000. Well, they were actually 100,000, but they didn't all come for this one battle. Some stayed in the ships or whatever, so there were 60,000 against 3,000. So that's kind of, you see the proportion. So that brings about also the question of private armies, national army, which we are concerned with right now because of the war going on in the Middle East. And it just shows that private armies just don't work. Like these guys, the Persian were using mercenaries. They were using people that they had conquered to go and conquer other people. What's the logic there? We're gonna pay you well. We're gonna have gonna pay your scholarship, we're gonna pay your just go and fight. And when you come back you'll get the citizenship. That's great. Why not? So they were 60,000. All right, we'll do it. But 60,000 what? They were not necessarily, real soldiers. That's the thing. The Athenian, which were massively the army there, was coming from Athens and other cities, but mainly from Athens. They were actually trained soldiers, and they had strategy, and they were defending their land. So it's not like somebody who just goes, "Hey, yeah, I'll go conquer Greece, I don't really know what that is because I come from the other end of the world," but I'll just do it for the pay. It's not really the same idea that you have in your head. Right? I gotta save my children, my wife, and my land. Not the same thing. So, but actually, there was also something else. You can't just win because, hey, that's my land. You can't do it. Like they're 60,000, you're 3,000. Well, got a problem there. So it's not just about your muscles. It's really about how you're gonna think about. All right, they're 12 times bigger than us. How do we do that? So you need strategy. You need to know. All right, you got to develop something. And can I show you something? It's gonna look like the bit people looked at the Super Bowl. Alright. Let's say that's the Persian. That's gonna be, I'm gonna call it the Greeks. Alright. Now, yeah, the Persian. Do you see that?
Yeah.
And I think that's fair. All right. So what's the challenge? So you have 60,000 on one side and 3,000 Greeks. Who goes first? Yeah. So actually they decided, all right.
So what we're going to do
is actually we're not much, so we're going to have to be efficient everywhere. So how did they do that? Okay, that's the part where it looks like NFL football. are you in red? So, Persians are coming that way. And what the Athenians and the other, the Greeks will do is that they'll put actually the weaker in the center. Well, it's not exactly that, but they'll act like if they're weak in the center. Hmm. And they'll just kind of retreat. So they'll move back. At the same time, these guys are going on the side. And they're, you know, the Persians are like, all right, that's so easy, let's go. And they don't get that, you know, they're going to be surrounded. And then, you know, like, I think that there's almost no injuries for the Greeks. And, like, they lost thousands of people in the Persian Empire, or the Persian army. So basically, you know, the Greeks are just, all right, hey, that's too tough. We're going to have to go back. But actually, that's the strategy. So we're going to, surround these guys so that they're going to be fighting against two people at the same time, or they're going to be, you know, completely deconcentrated, really disturbed. So that's how they managed to do it. And they surrounded the Persian army. But the idea was, we're going to surround them really quick, and then we're going to go back to let them flee. And that's what happened. So that's how they actually won the Battle of Marathon. So 3,000 against 60,000. Very cool. Mm-hmm. That's my argument against private armies. All right. No. So that battle was really famous. Like, everybody around Greece heard about, you know, the Battle of Marathon. So much that if you know a bit Greek literature, maybe you know this guy Aeschylus. He was a poet and a dramatist. And on his grave, you know, like the guy wrote like hundreds of pieces, and he won the prize for the best poet like a couple times, and he's really like really good. But what he decided is not like, all right, I wrote, you know, that play or that one, or I won that prize and all that. But he said, I fought at Marathon. I was there. And, you know, we kicked their ass. So that was like, all right, that's, you know, that's what I'm proud of. Because that's, you know, that's one battle where we saved our land and our people, and that's, you know, that's great. That's you know, it really shows what these guys had in mind. They knew that the old region, old Greece, was confronted to that empire of hundreds of thousands of just mercenaries ready to just destroy the land. And they said, no, we're gonna stand and we're gonna fight these guys. And they were trained as soldiers. They had the physical strength, but they had also mental strength. that strategy, and they were able to bring new ideas about how to do things. So, that brings us to that picture, which we saw yesterday if you were here, which is called the School of Athens, by Raphael. So that's the idea, like the big battle which we see in terms of ideas since less than 3,000 years ago is really reflected in the two characters in the middle of that painting, which is at the Vatican. And you see, it's really the question of the epistemological battle, the question of the ideas. What is an idea? Does it exist? And what do we do with ideas? Or where does that come from? So that's a fight between these two guys. On one side you have Plato on the left, which represent that type of the legacy of people like Solon, people like Thales. So law, you know, the Solon the lawgiver, and Thales, you know, the scientist. So that's his background. We're gonna go a bit through that. And on the other side you have Aristotle, which represent more of the oligarchic fashion too. You see how he's dressed? and also the empire, the idea of the empire. And that's reflected in his work. So what do you see, which, you know, could bring us to the idea that these guys are not the same? Like, you know, on that picture, do you see something that differentiate these two guys in the way they're acting or moving or speaking? No.
Plato's hand.
Plato's hand? What about
it? It's raised like this. Aristotle's hand is down.
Okay. What do you think that means? Is it really significant?
And he's pointing up. He's
pointing up?
Something about ideas.
All right. You saw that in a book, or
no,
the teacher told you, or?
I agree, it does have a different feeling.
Yeah?
You know, the hand pointing up is like sort of a higher ideal, and the hand forward is definitely sort of a denying or a no kind of movement.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. True. They're not saying the same thing. And actually you can see, it's kind of good. You see in the movement also of these two guys? If you hold your book on your leg, can you really move forward, or can you really do something? You stand still. He's
resting.
All right, don't move. And on the other side,
stepping. Or Plato is stepping.
Yeah, he's like, looks in motion. Looks like, you know, he's like dragging Aristotle with me. Hey, come with me.
Pascal.
That's the way.
Who's the artist of this?
That's Raphael. Raffaello Sanzio. Which was at the time, after Leonardo da Vinci was a follower.
What's it called?
Huh?
What's it called?
That's the School of Athens.
It's part of a bigger.
That's the old painting.
Okay.
So you see, yeah, you see that actually Plato is pointing up, and Aristotle is really saying, "Whoa, stop right here." And actually, if you think about something higher, well, you look here, you know, like there's, it's kind of unorthodox way of painting. Like you have be a bunch of people there, and just have nothing up. What's up with that? You know? So actually, Chloe's pointing up. He's pointing, maybe you heard about his theory of the ideas. So he's pointing up, but it's not, you know, it's not just, that's a representation of it. But you see these two characters, which are actually some gods. So you have Athena on your right, and I'm not too sure who's on the left. Somebody with a lyre. Not sure. But it's the domain of the gods, right? So you have that kind of idea, like, that we're going to explore a bit, where Plato says the ideas actually come from up there, like they exist in the realm of the gods. They were created there. And Aristotle is more like, well, look, we don't see it. It's just like, you know, you look at this guy, don't see gods flying all around the place and ideas dropping. So, I'm not sure it comes from there. Actually, I'm going to say that actually the ideas are not real. It's just like we see things, and from there, we can approximate, maybe, you know, the reason they're there. I'm not sure about the cause of it. I'm not going to study it. I'm going to tell you what's there. So that's a bit the difference between these two guys, which we're going to go through. I can't even say. So, in your classes, maybe you got philosophy classes? So some of you? Yeah, Luke? Alright, great. So in your class, Luke, what did they tell you about Plato and Aristotle?
Actually, in
nothing?
My class, they didn't even talk about Plato. Well, I don't remember.
Okay. Well,
I'll tell you one thing.
It was just sophism.
We went to Harvard University last week in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And in one of the science classes, we were going in to talk to the teachers and sing in the science classes.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked into this big, big, big lecture. And right at the beginning of class, they had techno music playing at the beginning of class, and this huge picture of Aristotle, massive, like covered the whole wall, like, you know, tech, you know, this
what?
Is the beginning of your class here.
Techno,
so you must
that,
worship
so
Aristotle
weird.
And listen to techno music.
But there was a what class? What?
Science class.
That means they don't do that in raves. That would be the end. But okay.
Well, in school, I just remember quickly, but remember when I was at Cégep, there was the, what you would see about Plato was just a question of method.
Mm-hmm.
Maieutic, he argues like that.
There's theoretical method.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Argument A, B, C, D.
Okay. And read the apology, cry for
yeah.
Socrates, but you don't really know the guy, really, because just... You were forced to read it, so you did it for the exam, and after that, all right, let's go for something else. Nietzsche. Or okay. So yeah, people say that there's a dichotomy between these two guys, and we saw it on the picture. I mean, it's pretty clear. But what do people say about Plato and Aristotle? Well, actually, people, well, what I've got and what I've seen also elsewhere, well, from my discussion with people in the streets, is that Plato, yeah, he's interesting, but no, it's too much of a utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Never gonna happen. It sounds great, but no. So he's a bit of a dreamer, right? He's
mm-hmm.
like, I read, you know, you wrote that book, The Republic, where, you know, everything's supposed to work fine and all that. But actually, you know, that's not how life goes. Yeah, you know, it doesn't work like that. But Aristotle is more like the guy. Like he's the one who says the true things, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy who says, like, you know, like the apple is green.
It's true.
The apple is green. So you know that's the idea. Now he doesn't really know where the apple come from. Maybe Newton has an idea. But Yeah, he's more of a realist. He's more like looking at things, and he gives you a, you know, gives you a feedback like, I've seen that, and you know, like, I'm gonna write a book about it. But actually, I don't really know where that comes from. So, but I had a discussion with one person at one point, and I don't know if you read a bit of Aristotle and Plato, you know, even just at school, just to pass the test.
Mm-hmm.
No? Okay. Well, actually, if you go into the ethic, or the Nicomachean ethics of Aristotle, you'll see that he starts from the beginning. He says, like, all right, so we gotta know how we're gonna you know, build society and all that. It's a question of power. You have different strata in the population. You have the citizens, you have the slaves, and so you don't really have many of them, of stratas, but you have many people in one strata and few people in the other one. And the idea is, all right, well, you know, slavery is, it's normal. It's just, you know, some people are best fitted to rule the country and some others are objects, like, and that's all he calls it. He says, like, you know, like, you're gonna have your knife. That's a good inanimate object or dead object. But actually, you know, you have animated objects, which are your slaves, and which are part of you in a sense, because you own them. So they're part of you, but you're not part of them. So that's the way he puts it, and that's really the relation he tries to establish from the start. Now, Plato has a different idea about that. I'm not going to go through it much in the sense that I'm going to give you a kind of challenge. And it's represented, don't read the book before trying to do it, but in the Meno dialogue of Plato, actually he brings the argument why slavery actually is not natural. Like, everybody has a potential to make discoveries, and that's in everybody, in the slave, in the master. Sometimes more in the slave, because they have to do things. The master just orders and, you know, do that. So they have they know how to do things, and everybody has the capacity to do it. Now, Aristotle comes afterward, you know, and someone was coming before. And what did Solon say? it's a question, you know, of the people. How do people think? That's what's gonna bring down our population, our society. Not the gods. So if you think about that, you know, you had a time where the Greeks had the method of what I brought with Marathon, this idea of the know-how. And basically the philosophy which that involves, or the conception that you have of yourself and of your of the peoples around you, led them to fight and win the Battle of Marathon, and after that of Salamis and Plataea and others.
Did you say that Nicomachean Ethics is a book on Aristotle's view on how to build a city?
The Nicomachean Ethics are like, it's kind of the copy paste of Plato's Republic. I didn't read them like all, because it's quite boring, but it's really a copy paste. Like, he's gonna put, like, okay, that's how you do it, but Plato's, like, you know, in a sense, it's the format, which looks a bit the same, but the idea are not the same. And that's what you have to look at. The substance, completely different. So, it's just, it's like, you know, la réplique, the response of Aristotle to Plato. like, you said that, now I'm going to say, you know, maybe, but, you know, slavery is normal, and other things also. So he's just responding, trying to argument against Plato, actually. But that, now it's a question of the method. What do they use? So basically, the empire, like we're going back to the Persian Empire, they had a trick. They used sophistry, and they used, well, other things, but that's how they actually corrupted people. Like, they tried to beat these Greeks, and they're just too tough. 3,000 or 60,000. We need like 100,000, million. So let's forget that, alright? We won't win by fighting them on the field. So we gotta find something else, right? So just remember what Solon says in the first sentence, and look at this type of, I don't know if I should call it philosophy, but that's the way they were brought to bring, you know, to think. So sophistry, what is sophistry? Or I call it Aristotelianism, and many other branch of the tree. But there's three kind of principle, which are that basically, look, we can't know anything but by our sense perception. You know, there's a chair there, I feel it, it's there. That's what I know. That's true, because I can feel it, right? The second one, well, there's no principle attached to that chair. It's there, and will be there unless I move it, right? That's elsewhere. It's not any kind of principle which we move things, or even the planets, or, you know, anything in the universe. It's just plainly what you see. It's, you know, you don't have to look at principles. You're never going to get it anyway. So that's the thing. So therefore, the third point is, okay, no natural law. There's no way you can figure out anything. There's no way you can reorganize society. So might is right. You know, the one who's the fittest survive. That's it. That's the rule, man. Well, I said there was no rule, but just don't. That's I meant that there's only one rule. That's called sophistry. Alright, so that's the way that they perverted actually the population of Greece. And they used that strategy because they just couldn't do it another way. So you still had these fight against these two factions. You had the faction of the kind of what we could call the Republicans, trying to save the city states, their city, their country. And you have the other faction which says, doesn't really matter, we could all have the same money, no problem. The same restaurant, no problem. And the same ideas, no problem. You know, we could all be fit, like the same. You know, the fittest will survive.